Hi, welcome to this week's program. My topic for today is, are you getting your financial news from a trustworthy source or not? Because nowadays, websites and blogs are inexpensive and easy to put together, and there's a lot of junk financial content out there that's not trustworthy at all, filled with junk claims and junk data, boosting all sorts of dubious and not so dubious securities. I guess I should call it fake financial news. You know, that's the term of the day, and I credit President Trump for giving me the idea for today's topic. Now, here's some hard data behind fake financial news. The SEC charged 27 individuals and entities with perpetrating a variety of stock promotion schemes. SEC investigators found that certain publicly traded companies had hired PR firms to promote their stocks under the guise of independent research, but failed to disclose the compensation aspects. So these articles were nothing more than paid advertisements. Stephanie Avakian, acting director of the SEC's Division of Enforcement, said, "If a company pays someone to publish or publicize articles about its stock, it must be disclosed to the investing public. These companies, these promoters and writers, allegedly misled investors by disguising paid promotions as objective and independent analysis." For example, in 2013, a publicly traded company called Galena Biopharma misled investors by commissioning over 100 paid articles that promoted Galena on investment websites, including one article on Seeking Alpha, where the author falsely stated that he had not been paid to write the article. Galena paid over $20,000 per month for these fake financial news articles and launched a 240-day blitz on social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, and they targeted to retail investors. None of those articles or posts disclosed that it was paid content. As a result, Galena shares jumped from under $2 to $7 per share, and Galena insiders profited handsomely by selling shares at elevated prices. The SEC filed charges and fined Galena and its CEO, but no one went to jail. So be wary of legitimate posts on well-known sites. Now, I'm not saying it's all fake, but there sure is a lot of fake financial news out there disseminated through a web of interconnected sites, which makes it hard to tell real from fake. So in some ways, while the internet has made stock research much, much easier, and it's empowered retail investors, the proliferation of fake news has made the role of the financial advisor all the more necessary, in my view. Necessary because most amateur investors need a grounded, credible person to help parse the good from the bad, to help you identify financial news that's trustworthy and credible. In another example, one hired writer hyped stocks under his own name and under at least 9 other made-up names. These names were Equity Options Guru, The Swiss Trader, Trading Maven, and Wonderful Wizard. And in one of his bios, he bogusly claimed to be an analyst and fund manager with almost 20 years of investment experience. So that's clearly a violation of authenticity and definitely qualifies as fake financial news. The SEC went on to find several publicly traded companies involved and still has a few cases pending. In addition, the SEC issued an alert warning investors to make investment decisions solely on the basis of articles published on investment research sites, but to research the company thoroughly using multiple sources. Amen to that. Now, I'm going to add that the SEC's own website is a great source of genuine company data information that public companies are required to report quarterly, and I'll make sure there's a link on my website. All you have to do, though, is go to the SEC's EDGAR company filings, E-D-G-A-R. You go to the website, SEC's EDGAR company filings website, and enter the company's name or ticker symbol to get information. And best of all, it's completely free and 100% trustworthy. Now, while fines are a bit of a deterrent, I think the SEC only got to the tip of the iceberg. Probably doesn't have the resources to chase down investment scammers that are often based outside the U.S., hiding behind anonymous servers in the dark web. So the SEC's enforcement actions aren't going to stop fake financial news. And that's why I'm talking about this right now. If you come across a story that makes a stock look extraordinarily attractive, don't get overexcited and rush to buy. Instead, take a deep breath. See if there's any fine print that says the post is a paid advertisement or that the author owns shares in the company. If there is proper fine print, that's good. If the post appears too bullish and there's no fine print, then treat that as a red flag. Also, check the author's bio. Google his or her name to see if it's a ghostwriter or a pseudonym, or if the author is genuine and credible. If everything checks out, it could still be fake financial news because scammers always get more sophisticated when law enforcement gets involved. So dig deeper to see if that stock is worth adding to your portfolio. Next, go to websites such as Google Finance or Yahoo Finance or your brokerage firm. Type in the company's name or ticker symbol and check its valuation. Check its price-to-earnings ratio, its recent news, its most recent earnings press release. Do your own due diligence to decide if a stock is attractive and figure out what that due diligence is so you can get to it right away. Now, here's something else you should know. Most brokerages are members of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, easier said as FINRA, and cannot knowingly publish false or misleading information. Moreover, their publicly available content has to be carefully screened for fairness and balance. So, using your broker's website to research stock is always a safer bet. On the flip side, online publishers of financial news that are not FINRA members are not bound by FINRA's balanced and fair guidelines and could publish stuff that is biased, untrue, and knowingly misleading. So, watch out for fake financial news from such non-FINRA sites. Google and Yahoo Finance sites also give you links to articles on the stock. Read articles from multiple sources over at least the past 3 months to get a better picture of the company. The good news here is that buyers and sellers of the same stock often present and publish very different views on the same company. I like that. So looking up different sources will give you a good sense of the stock's pros and cons and alert you to what is fake financial news and what is not. And if you're a serious investor like Warren Buffett and his ilk, you should also read the company's quarterly financial filings, also known as the 10Q, and their annual reports, known as the 10K. And you can find those at the SEC websites, and you can also get them through links from Google and Yahoo and other sites. Look at the CEO's comments. Look at the CFO's comments. And look up the company's revenue, their earnings, earnings per share, debt levels, and cash flow. And look for patterns over the last few quarters to see if they match the investment research site that's promoting the stock. If everything still looks good, maybe you should consider buying the stock. If you have a financial advisor, consult him or her about how this stock would fit in to your overall financial portfolio goals and get a trusted second opinion. Then invest with peace of mind and the confidence that you're not a victim of fake financial news. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Well, good news, folks. We finally may be seeing some relief regarding health premium pricing and availability in the health insurance market. And to get a handle on this, I've asked Kim Langford from Kiplinger's Personal Finance to join me today. She's a regular guest on this show, and she's going to help us pick a better health insurance policy. Hey, Kim, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So in the last few years, healthcare costs have been marching steadily upward. Insurers have been raising premiums to keep pace. But is the rate of change, the rate of increase changing now?
It is. Actually, there's kind of good news. I mean, like you said, there's been a lot of increases, very large increases in health insurance costs over the last several years. But they're starting to stabilize a little bit. Whether you have insurance through your employer or on your own, the average cost increase across the country is about 5%. And for people who have employer coverage, that's the same as it's been for the last several years. But people on their own, it's stabilizing. This is considered stabilizing a little bit.
Yeah.
Increases had been so much over the last several years. And you may also have several new options. Some new insurers are coming back into the market or entering the individual market. So there may be many more options to have during open enrollment this year than you had in the past.
I know in my own company last year and the year before, we saw some horrendous price increases in premiums. We've had to switch insurance companies and, you know, kind of rush back and forth to try to get something. But, you know, I hate to say 5% increase. It's almost twice the rate of inflation, but that's good news. 5% is good news.
It's good news compared to the last few years. And just like your business did for individuals, a lot of them will have the same type of situation. If the plan that they currently have has big price increases, take a look at your other options because there are some new options out there. I found a lot of people who, you know, if they didn't mind switching to a smaller provider network, were able to save a decent amount of money. And it's trade-offs like that. That's what they need to consider is premiums versus out-of-pocket costs versus having the doctors and hospitals they want to have covered.
That's true. So let's get to the policies themselves and see how we can save our listeners some money. So, you know, we know that policies come in all shapes and sizes, but particularly with regard to deductibles, high deductibles, low deductibles, that translates to a change in the premium. And high deductibles also have the benefit of you being able to develop or start or fund an HSA account. Tell us about that.
Well, and that's one of the benefits of a high deductible plan. The difficult thing is everyone's been having to pay higher deductibles, whether you have insurance through your employer or on your own. And people on their own especially have had some very high deductibles. But kind of a bit of a silver lining is that if you have a deductible of at least $1,350 for individual coverage or $2,700 for family coverage, you'll be able to contribute to a health savings account. And this provides actually a triple tax benefit. Your contributions are either tax deductible or pre-tax if it's through your employer. The money grows tax deferred and can be used tax-free for eligible medical expenses in any year. So this isn't like a flexible spending account where you have to spend it by the end of the year. This, you can keep it in the account. Many of them have mutual funds that you can invest in and have the money grow tax deferred for the future. And as long as you're using it for eligible medical expenses, you can withdraw it tax-free. Also, after you're 65, you can even withdraw the money tax-free for Medicare Part B, Part D, and Medicare Advantage
premiums. Yeah.
You can't make new contributions after you're on Medicare, but a lot of people are now considering this as kind of an extra stash of money for retirement healthcare expenses.
Yeah, you know, I've seen that in my own practice with clients coming in with, you know, $43,000 in their HSA, and they've used it as a tax-free savings account, and I think it's really quite a good way if you can, in fact, afford to pay out of pocket for your regular ongoing expenses. You know, one thing that I think it's important to realize is that insurance is for catastrophic purposes. You know, your house burns down, things of that nature. So you really should have a high deductible, even though it's painful when you go into the doctor, you get prescriptions, it is painful. But one way that keeps your premium costs down is by getting a high deductible. And that's really what insurance is for. What if I don't expect to have much in medical expenses for the upcoming year? Is there something I can do or way of thinking that could save me money?
Well, in that case, really, it is a benefit to go with a high deductible plan. And, you know, you never know what your medical expenses are going to be during the year. But in that case, you could set aside the money in the HSA if you can afford to contribute the extra money, pay for any medical expenses that you do end up having up to that deductible out of your pocket, and then keep that money growing in the HSA for those future expenses when you may have a lot more medical expenses. Another key thing is, because nobody knows what is going to happen during the year, it's really important to look at the out-of-pocket maximum coverage that the policy has. And, you know, this is the coverage, the average actually is about $3,500 for employee-only coverage. This is for employees, and individual coverage is about the same. And family coverage is about, you know, $7,000 on average for employee family coverage. And that is the most that you could pay out of your pocket for deductibles and co-payments. Generally, this is just for in-network care. But this is if you end up having, you know, much, much bigger medical expenses than you're thinking about. Or if you do have medical issues, look at that, because you may end up having to, you know, kind of max out your health insurance. But the good thing about those policies that, you know, that have that type of coverage, and, you know, this is, you know, under the ACA law, has this type of coverage with no coverage maximums, you will get everything covered after you reach those out-of-pocket maximums. But just really understand how that works. Talk with your employer or the insurance company about what's included in that amount, whether it's, you know, your deductibles for your whole family, whether it's your out-of-pocket costs, and then, you know, kind of keep that in the back of your mind, even if you're healthy, that this is what you'd have to pay if you did have a major medical emergency.
Well, I think there is some comfort in the idea that your total out-of-pocket is capped. And, you know, again, we see what the bills from hospitals are. There are these horrendous numbers. And to know that you're capped at $3,500 or whatever the number is, I think, the whole idea about insurance. One thing that I noticed when I was studying your notes was that there's new features to a plan called the Centers of Excellence program. That sounded really interesting. What is that?
Yeah, this has been a growing trend, especially in employer coverage. And a lot of these plans now are helping you pay to go to some major hospitals, especially things like in cardiac care, some, you know, knee joint type things, bariatric surgery, cancer care, some hospitals like Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic that are specialists in this care that may not even be in your state. And this is especially an employer plan. Sometimes they're having a center of excellence where they will consider that in-network care and may even pay some of your expenses to, you know, to stay there or travel there in order to get that care, because they are looking at the statistics and finding out that the care is, you know, very good care where they're not having to have a lot of, you know, a lot of complications afterwards, and the employer plans are deciding it's in their best interest to cover that even if it's not nearby.
Some of the other things that are covered, fertility treatments and bariatric surgery, which I was surprised to read, those are also covered in it. So you really want to check with your company's policy to see whether, in fact, this Centers of Excellence program is available. All right, what about strategies for people with higher incomes? Tell us about that.
Well, that's the difficult thing. So if you're buying insurance on your own and your income is below 400% of the federal poverty level, and that's $48,560 for singles, $65,000, almost $66,000 for couples, and just over $100,000 for a family of four, people whose income are below that level will get a subsidy to help pay their premiums. And so if you buy on your state marketplace or healthcare.gov, then you will get a big or small portion, depending on your level of income, of the premiums covered through that tax credit. However, if your income is higher than that, those are the people who have the biggest sticker shock.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of our readers are early retirees who may actually have pretty high income, especially when they count the money that they're withdrawing from their, you know, tax-deferred accounts like 401ks and IRAs, or if they have a taxable pension. In that case, you really need to really do whatever you can to lower the cost. First of all, if you're near the cutoff, really think carefully about what you can do to lower some of those expenses.
So, like, maybe not take so much money out of your IRA, as an example.
That's exactly right. I talked with a reader who had been doing exactly that, and they, you know, had gone over top of the limit and then realized they had just missed it by a little bit, and decided to kind of, you know, tighten their belts. They were going to be going on Medicare in just a few years, and just really limit what they were taking out of their IRAs and 401ks until they went on Medicare. in order to be able to qualify for the subsidy. So take a look at what those limits are. There's calculators at healthcare.gov and on the state sites that can help you figure out how close you are to those cutoffs.
Kiplinger does a really good job here. They have articles, for example, the 7 ways to save on prescriptions, and they've really done a very good job, which is why we have them continually back on the show, because their research is deep and it's broad and it's exactly what we're looking for. So Kiplinger.com. Kim, is there a specific place on the site people can go to?
Actually, I think right now the lead article, since open enrollment is about to get started and going on with many employer plans right now, I think we've got it right in the front of the site. But I also do a column called Ask Kim, and you can go to Kiplinger.com/AskKim and find all my columns there too.
Okay, we'll put all that on the site. And of course, to hear this and any interview again, to ask a question of anything we've discussed, don't forget to go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, join our weekly update, where we will send you all of the news and all of the shows and segments that we're doing on a week-to-week basis. I think you'll really enjoy that. That's stevepomerantz.com. Thanks, Kim.
Well, thank you very much.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Well, as I record this, the election just took place the previous night, and with me to get a sense of what it all means financially, I've invited back to the show Rick Newman. He's a senior columnist at Yahoo Finance. Welcome back to the show, Rick.
Thanks, Steve.
So as I sit here, the market's up about 300 points, so I don't know whether it's a relief rally or whether something more important than that, but what is your take now on the markets, and especially after this terrible October, what it might mean today that we're up?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the outcome in the midterms was almost exactly what investors expected and what Wall Street expected. So, I mean, it didn't matter so much from an investor's perspective to get down into a race by race basis. And there certainly were a few surprises here and there. But basically, the outlook was for the House of Representatives to flip from Republican control to Democratic control. That happened.
Yep.
And the outlook was also for the Senate to remain in Republican control. And that happened also. So Wall Street, for once, got exactly the outcome it expected. So there's no surprise here that would push markets in any surprising direction. I think there is also a relief element to this also. I mean, you know, uncertainty has now been removed. And one interesting thing I noticed this morning with a bunch of the Wall Street notes going around, every, you know, Wall Street firm is saying, here's what we think the impact of the midterm outcomes will be. There is actually some relief that there will not be an additional tax cut likely to make its way through Congress. And that might sound a little counterconventional, but here's the logic. We know that Congress already cut taxes late last year. Trump signed that. It was a big tax cut for corporations.
Right.
So the worry is that further tax cuts means the U.S. government would have to borrow even more money to cover the difference, and that would push interest rates up. So the sort of bank shot logic here is that if we're not going to get another tax cut, that's a little less upward pressure on interest rates. Perhaps that lets the Federal Reserve hold off just a little bit in terms of its tightening. So markets are interpreting that as good news, at least for today.
Well, also, if you look ahead, and if we do run into recession sometime in 2019, 2020, if the debt is ridiculously high or as high as it's ever been, it will give Congress less maneuvering room in order to stimulate the economy. So there's some worry there that having such a high debt will inhibit the government's ability to reduce the pain of the next recession.
You're certainly right about that. Although I think this has been a concern for such a long time that I think in terms of financial markets, you know, trying to guess what's likely to happen tomorrow or the next week or next month, I think the financial markets just are not concerned about the level of debt at the U.S. government these days. Now, that could change fast if we hit a scenario such as you just described, and that huge amount of debt, it's close to $21 trillion now, I think, and we're going to have deficits of probably at least $1 trillion this year. I mean, if that does begin to impact the ability of the United States to do deficit spending, to borrow during a downturn and do some of that conventional stimulus, for sure, that would have a pronounced effect on financial markets. But at least at the, you know, economists worry about that at the moment. Not too many Wall Street people are worried about that.
I absolutely agree. I don't want to belabor this point, but one final point is that with the deficit running at $1 trillion a year, I mean, these are normally the deficits you see when the economy is bad and the government is spending, not when the economy is good. So I think everybody's waiting to see if lower corporate taxes, some lower individual taxes, is going to spur the economy enough to make up the difference. But let's move on.
Let's move on. I could talk on and on about it, but let's move on.
You wrote a column on November 5th that said, after hovering for 8 months at a B grade on the Yahoo Finance Trumponomics report card, that President Trump's rating has drifted up to a B plus. Describe that for us.
Sure. We've been tracking the health of the Trump economy, or I guess I should say the economy under Trump, since May of 2017. This is quantitative, so it's based purely on a methodology we've created and the numbers that go into that. We look at things like total employment, manufacturing employment, four other indicators that everybody would understand. And we compare the economy under Trump to the performance of the economy under six presidents going back to Richard Nixon and say, how is Trump doing compared to these other presidents at the same point in their term? Trump had been at a B. That was the grade that the numbers were telling us for the last 8 months. And it recently ticked up to a B plus. Mm-hmm. And the main thing that changed there is his grade for average hourly earnings. When we compare it to the prior presidents, it actually ticked up a notch. S&P 500, Trump is still the, even despite the sort of backsliding in October you just referred to, Trump still gets the second highest mark out of seven presidents on that. And that's enough to give him a B plus.
Okay.
That is a very good grade. I mean, you know, people would forget this, but the U.S. economy, which was mainly an industrial economy back then, was adding far more jobs in the 1970s under the first couple of years of Jimmy Carter. Hard to believe, I know, looking back, because the Carter presidency didn't end well.
Right.
But man, the U.S. economy was creating like twice the number of jobs we see now. And that's because it was a totally different economy.
Yeah.
So a B plus grade, given the dynamics of today's economy, I think is very good.
So maybe there will be a dividend. Maybe there are some early signs that if more people are working, if those people are making more money, they will pay more in taxes. And maybe that theory of trickle down or whatever you want to call it will work. We have to wait and see.
I won't endorse. All I'll say is
no.
I will not endorse that theory, but you're right.
Yeah.
It could happen.
You know, I was around during Reagan times and I'm still waiting for the trickle down, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it's coming. Looking ahead a little bit, how much of the election results had to do with a good economy? We have an excellent economy and normally, you know, it's the economy, stupid. How would you account for that?
Yes, this to me is a very interesting question. So, you know, this looks like a setback for Trump, given that he lost his party, the Republicans lost control of the House. But the Republicans actually outperformed in the midterm elections based on the normal, well, let's call it the average performance of the party in power during midterm elections. They lost fewer seats in the House than is typical for a president whose popularity rating is below 50%, as Trump's is. And they actually gained seats in the Senate. What's normal is a loss of a couple of seats in the Senate for a president with a approval rating than 50%. So while it might not feel like a victory for Republicans, they actually did better than expected compared with historical norms. And I think the reason for that is that the economy is very strong. I mean, interestingly, the economy came in as the third not the first. It's usually the first most important issue when you ask voters what they care about the most. This time around, it was third. Healthcare was first, immigration was second, and then came the economy. Mm-hmm. And we also had a lot of people saying the economy is in good shape. Almost twice as many people as in 2016, just 2 years ago, saying the economy is in good shape. So I think that what that tells me is that there are some voters, I've talked with many of them, who really don't like President Trump and they don't like all of his policies, but they do give him credit for a good economy and they just don't want to break what seems to be working. And so those are votes that I think Trump maybe got that he wouldn't get if the economy were weaker. Or they could feel people who just felt no need to cast a protest vote in favor of Democrats and may have stayed home. Mm-hmm. So I think Trump absolutely is benefiting from a strong economy.
Well, I think 2020 is going to be based on the factor of what the economy is going to be doing at that point. If it's very good now, I mean, it may stay very good for a long period of time. These trends tend to last a very long time, especially if unemployment is completely continuing to fall, wages are rising. I mean, these are very good things that don't turn on a dime. But 2020 is far away. All kinds of things can happen. And so maybe it will turn into the economy, stupid.
Well, I think the economy will be decisive in 2020, whether it's a strong economy or a weak economy. We know that Trump is able to sustain what seems to many people, including me, to be a surprisingly high level of support, even if it's not high by historical standards. But he is so divisive and so controversial, and yet he does seem to have the support of just enough voters to put him barely over the top or maybe close to being over the top. So if the economy is the same in 2020 as it is today, I mean, that will be a good thing for Trump. But, you know, based on what economists are forecasting and a lot of people are worried about, I think the stronger case is that we will have the economy will probably not be as strong in 2020 as it is today. Most mainstream economic forecasts see the economy weakening, growth getting slower. There are some forecasts for a recession around 2020 or 2021. I think a big question is whether if we just have a slowing economy, but not a recession, is that something people are really going to feel, you know, feel like they're okay? Are we going to have layoffs and you're going to hear about people losing their jobs and companies downsizing? Or are we just going to have a little less hiring that, you know, is something people with a job won't really feel? I think that's a big question. It's kind of like, where will the economy be on the margins? And a lot of things can and will happen during the next 2 years.
Well, there's so much we can't tell about the future, especially 2020. So why don't we leave it at that? Rick Newman, senior columnist at Yahoo Finance, just trying to give us some insight as to what happened and maybe what's going to happen in the future. Hey, Rick, thanks for joining us.
Always enjoy it. Thank you.
To hear this and any interview again, and if you have a question about what we've just discussed or an opinion, write to us at stevepomerantz.com and sign up for our weekly update where you'll get all of this information right into your inbox every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. She's a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I have a question for you regarding pricing of homes using artificial intelligence, these websites.
Yep.
I won't mention any names.
Thank you.
And homeowner themselves pricing their home for sale. The discrepancy. What is the discrepancy?
Oh, yes, there is. Actually, they're fairly similar in a lot of ways.
Okay.
So the difference is, so you have this artificial intelligence. They're looking at a different angle. They're looking, comparing it to other homes in the neighborhood, but it doesn't necessarily know everything. It doesn't take into account maybe you're on the water.
Yeah.
Another house isn't. It'll do like a 1 mile radius. And, you know, the neighborhood right next door to you is a lesser value. So it gives you a trend, if you will. A homeowner, on the other hand, they're emotionally attached to their house. So they're counting every dime. It's like, oh, you know, I put these granite countertops on. That's $3,500.
Yeah.
I did this. I did that. So they're coming in from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
But when all was said and done, they weren't that far apart.
Which is kind of interesting. But, you know, we've always sensed that there is this big discrepancy. When you go online and you look and you put in your address and your house is worth X and you go, yeah, you know, that's good. Actually, they also have a chart. In the last 30 days, there's a line. It's gone down. It's like, really? How did they?
Right.
What do you mean it's gone down? You know, also the problem is, and I think you guys have the same problem, if not a lot of homes sell in a recent period, what are your comps? What are you comparing to?
Right. That's a real problem.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is, both the artificial intelligence and the sellers, in my opinion, are always overpriced.
Always overpriced.
Always overpriced.
They think the property is worth more.
Yeah. And so it's kind of fun. I always like asking the question before I meet with someone, where do you think your home value is?
Okay.
Just to hear how they're going to come up with their answer. Well, yeah. I looked at this site or I looked at that site. Or they'll go in and tell me all about their upgrades.
That's right. Well, that's not, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Well, if you put in a pool, maybe.
Yeah. I'd say if you had a pool or added square footage to the house.
Yeah,
but,
right.
You know,
right.
If you put in new kitchen cabinets and they're not what a buyer would want them to be, what good are they?
Yeah, that's
true. You know, I hope you enjoyed them.
Well, I think human beings, for the most part, are optimistic. You know, I think to be happy in life, you have to have kind of an optimistic streak, right?
Right, right.
We tend to think that we're above average drivers, you know? And when you think about it, if you ask a group of people, you know, raise your hand if you think you're an above average driver, almost everybody raises their hand. Now, that's not possible because you can't have more than average for everybody putting up their hands because then that's not average. So we tend to overestimate our skills and, you know, maybe how good looking we are as well. But the bottom line is I think they're doing it with the houses as well, right?
Exactly.
That's really
exactly.
The bottom
line. And they always compare their house to somebody else's house who's on the market that's probably overpriced.
Yeah.
And they'll say, oh, well, my house is nicer. You know, I just got a new coat of paint online.
My house is always nicer. Yeah, but look, if you do overprice your house, then that could lead to some negative consequences because you could lose momentum.
That's right.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
So, you know, we're starting to see a shift in the market. And basically with a shift, you don't want to be the overpriced property. Mm. Believe it or not, Steve, when the market's starting to shift, you're better off pricing your house slightly below market and you'll create more momentum and possibly sell it for more money than you would if you tried to price it above, slightly above market.
This shift you're talking about is the shift from a seller's market where the seller kind of has the power because there's low inventory and lots of demand. The shift, now we're not there yet, but the shifting
We're in it.
We're in it. Okay, so more of a buyer's market where there's more inventory and buyers have an opportunity to be more choosy.
That's right. Now, we're not necessarily in a buyer's market right now. I would say we're in the shift. It's
in the
transitioning to that. We're not...
Yeah, and you're doing it every day.
We're not officially in a buyer's market.
No, I understand. You're doing it every day, so you can feel it, you can smell it.
You can smell it,
yeah.
Taste it, feel it, breathe it. It's there.
So logically speaking, if now you've got more competition down the street,
that's right.
Maybe you want to underprice your house a little bit to get somebody's attention.
To get their attention, to make your house stand above the others. Because, Steve, like anything else in life, you're going to buy what you've perceived to be the best value. So if there are 10 homes and one is priced at X and the other one's priced at Y and they're both very similar and the X one is priced better than the Y, which one are you going to buy?
Yeah.
The X.
Well, okay. So also all the listings are lining up on your webpage, right?
That's right.
And so you can kind of see the stats. There's that little block and
right.
Then you're looking at the price and you're going, oh, you know, if the price is, you're going to be more attracted to the lower price. You may see that first.
You're going to perceive it as better value.
Yeah. And if you go there first and you've got a good person who's selling the property, then they may anchor
on
that.
They may anchor. And you know what? The truth of the matter is the buyers know their values because they're the ones who are spending the most amount of time mm-hmm. going through the online sites. And if it's overpriced, Steve, they'll just sit there and they'll wait. They'll say, and I hear it all the time, we'll go take a look at it when it's priced better. Yeah. We'll wait for them to adjust the price.
So they don't come in and they don't make an offer.
No, though. They don't. And that's the misconception that sellers have. Sellers believe, well, I'll just price it here. And if they like it, just make me an offer.
Yeah, no.
Buyers only buy when they perceive it to be good value. Not my perception, not your perception, their perception.
God, that is a huge lesson to learn, I have to tell you.
It is huge.
I think I'm kind of guilty. It's huge. I'm kind of guilty of this idea, you know, so they'll just make an offer and we'll get to it, but not necessarily.
No.
That's not the psychology.
No. If you're overpriced, they may come look at your house to validate the lower priced home. Like, wow, we're really getting a good buy. We got to go on this one. I see that all the time.
Oh, my God.
So the overpriced ones do get shown, but for the wrong reasons.
All right. Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, 30-year veteran with Keller Williams. Located in Boca Raton, Florida. She can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. My next guest asks a great question. He asks, why do we pay so much for healthcare in the United States and get so little in return? His name is Marshall Allen, and he is an award-winning reporter for ProPublica, which is an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism. And I was particularly attracted to what his writings with a particular article. It was entitled, Health Insurers Are Vacuuming Up Details About You, and it could raise your rates. Hey, Marshall, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
So without any public scrutiny, insurers and data brokers are predicting our health costs based upon data about us, social media data and other things. They're looking at our race, our marital status, how much TV we watch, and whether we pay our bills on time, or even if we buy plus-size clothing. Is this something brand new? Have they been doing this for years, but it's been accelerated by the growth of algorithms and big data?
Well, they've definitely been building profiles on us for years, and they've been trying to predict our costs for years. I mean, that's kind of what they're in the business of doing. You know, they want to make sure they can bring in enough money to cover any potential costs, and they want to make sure that they understand any risk that any of us pose. I think what's different about this story and what's new here is that they're working with data brokers to gather a lot of non-health information about us and then make inferences about our healthcare costs. And then possibly, I mean, I wasn't able to determine if it's happening yet, but possibly that information could be used to raise our rates and what we pay, or it could be used to discriminate against patients, or it could be used to structure plans in ways that could pass costs on to patients.
Well, let's think about this. So who are these data brokers? You know, there's a business for everything. If you see a niche and you can fill it, what kind of companies have this data and are able then to package it and sell it to insurers?
Well, so the biggest one that I featured in my story is LexisNexis. And LexisNexis is very well known for the research they do, legal research. I mean, we use their research here as investigative reporters. Mm-hmm. You know, they gather information from public records. And so it could be gathered from lawsuits, from land records, from financial records, credit scores, liens, your race, your education level, the amount of crime that's in your neighborhood, They said that they have more than 400 variables that they have used to correlate to someone's healthcare costs. And then they put together risk scores for healthcare costs based on this non-health information.
Yeah.
And so that's information that they're then marketing to the health insurance industry to help predict the cost of patients.
You know, when I think of big data, I don't think of someone's name and life being associated with it as an identity. I see it as just kind of a sea or an ocean of data that comes together mathematically to derive at certain conclusions. Is this different?
Well, yeah, it's very personal, actually. I mean, you know, this has been done for a long time in the marketing and sales world, right? And we all sense that when we're searching for something on Google and then we start seeing ads pop up for it, you know, to try and sell us based on our search habits. So we all know that we're being tracked more and more, and it is incredibly personal. So they're building individual profiles for us. Another company I featured is called Optum. Optum is owned by United Healthcare, which is the largest health insurance company in the country and one of the largest companies in the country. Mm-hmm. Optum said they are building profiles on hundreds of millions of individual Americans, and they recently filed for a patent that would gather people's social media posts, so Facebook posts or Twitter posts, other things we put on social media. They have text mining programs, and they would then somehow, they didn't say exactly how, but they would somehow use this to link to our healthcare costs.
Yeah. So, I mean, that sounds incredibly disturbing. Some of the things I mentioned, they know our TV habits in some way. I guess they know our shopping habits, so they can tell if we're buying plus size clothing. That's kind of understandable. But I don't really understand how they're getting all of this other information. It's not public information, how much TV I watch.
Well, so for instance, with shopping habits, right? So if you use a rewards card for your grocery store, they can take that information and sell it. So they're giving you a discount to buy items so that they can take that data that they're tracking on you and sell it on the back end. I talked to one vendor. I went to a health insurance conference, and really it was more like a tech conference in the vendor hall. But I talked to one vendor who said, you know, they can see if you have an Amazon Prime membership. If you have an Amazon Prime membership, it tells them a lot about the type of purchasing habits and the types of things that you buy. And I think one of the most sort of disturbing aspects of this is the inferences that they're making. And so, for instance, you mentioned the plus size clothing. You know, if you're a woman who's purchased plus size clothing, what they say in their marketing materials is that they would say that you're considered at risk of depression. And, you know, mental health is something that can be expensive. Or if you're low income and a minority, then the data brokers would say you're more likely to live in a dilapidated and dangerous neighborhood.
Yeah.
And that can increase your health risks. Or even think about a woman who's recently changed her name. So she could be newly married, or maybe she is recently divorced. So maybe she's about to get pregnant, you know, if she's a newlywed, or maybe she's stressed out and anxious from the divorce. And so the computer models then would predict that you're going to have higher medical bills.
A few weeks ago, I interviewed Gary Smith. He's a professor of economics at Pomona College, and he wrote a wonderful book called The AI Delusion. And he said that the belief in our artificial intelligence is overblown. He said it used to be with computers, garbage in, garbage out. You've heard that, right?
Yep, I have, yeah.
And now it's garbage in, gospel out. So we're believing this information that's coming out. And there's also, you know, this idea that, you know, correlations of data, you know, don't prove causation. As a matter of fact, there's a wonderful website I always reference on this show. It's called Spurious Correlations. I don't know if you've seen that, but it measures, you know, how many lawyers there are and, you know, how many people cut themselves from peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Ridiculous, unrelated events that show correlation somehow in this great mass of data.
Well, and I think that's probably the most offensive thing about this practice is that just because a woman purchases plus size clothing does not mean that every woman who falls in that category would be depressed.
Of course.
And so that's exactly why using non-health information is even more troubling than using, you know, health information, which they also get very invasive with health information as well.
Well, doesn't HIPAA govern this? You know, that form that we sign that protects our medical information?
Well, this is not medical information, so it's not governed by HIPAA at all.
Mm-hmm. So is it a question of whether the government has not yet kept up with this changing technology? Because I know in Europe, this is now outlawed, right?
Right. So Europe passed a law that created much more stringent privacy requirements for data. And one expert I talked to about the European law, which I think they call the General Data Protection Law, they have the presumption that your data would be private. So this personal information about you would not be able to be used and then trafficked by data brokers.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the United States, we haven't really had these conversations. And so the presumption is that all this information is public.
Right.
It can be gathered, it can be tracked, it can be monetized, and then it can be traded, you know, by these data brokers. And in this case, I'm looking at how the insurance industry is using it and all the troubling implications there.
Well, let's talk about what drives the insurance industry. You know, you think that they would be very interested in lowering costs for procedures and reducing the amount of surgeries, let's say, or visits to the emergency room. They're kind of acting on our behalf as insurance providers to whom we are paying our premiums. But it actually, from another article that I read that you posted, that's really not their incentive. Their incentive is not to save costs. Tell us a little bit about how insurance companies really get paid.
Well, you know, this is sort of stating the obvious, but their real incentive is to make money, right? And we sort of think, and this is what's been so interesting as I've learned more about the industry, we think because we are their members that they are supposed to be acting on our behalf. But what I've been trying to show through this series of stories is that the industry is actually aligning itself with other industry players with a lot of side deals, a lot of behind the scenes type of contracts and agreements that are not visible to the patient so that they can make more money off of us. And I think one of the first misconceptions is that insurance companies are actually the ones paying our bills. It's actually the patients are the ones who pay the bills. The insurance companies are the middlemen, and what they want to do is pool the risk and try and predict the risk. And once they can hopefully accurately predict the risk, then they know how much to charge all the people who are paying into that pool of risk. And hopefully then they can manage those costs so that the costs don't exceed the amount of money they've brought in. But it's kind of like they just take a cut. They take an administrative fee and a fee for profit off of the total. And they would tell you that their profits are actually relatively modest, like 3 or 4% a year, which is actually relatively true when you look at their financial statements. But the difference is that if they can make that overall pool of money bigger, if the healthcare costs can go up, then their 3 or 4% of relatively modest sounding profit every year can continue to grow every year. And so they do continue to bring in better value for their shareholders because they keep bringing in more money.
All right. So let me kind of summarize what you've said. If this was a true member organization, they would be interested in keeping costs down and keeping premiums at a certain level. Let's say that they were themselves paying the premiums and they were watching out after their own financial interests. They weren't kind of a third party broker that was just making commission off of doing administrative. They actually had skin in the game. Then they would want to keep their premiums down, and therefore they want to keep their costs down so they could earn the difference between the two. But what I'm understanding now is that that's not how it works. They are really making a percentage of the revenue, so their only interest is in making sure that they are able to price our premium correctly by saying, well, heck, you know, the costs have risen by so-and-so. We didn't care what we paid. So costs have gone up, and that means that there's more revenues coming in, and they'll increase their revenues by pricing it at their cost plus an administration fee. And so with rising revenues at a 3% commission, they will earn more. And so their really only incentive is to increase their revenues, not to decrease their expenses. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's correct. And the Affordable Care Act actually kind of codified this through what's called the medical loss ratio. And that was in the law, it got put in place that they have to spend anywhere from like 80 to 85% of the money they bring in on medical care itself. Mm-hmm. So their administration and profit can only total, say, 15 to 20%. And so the real way they have to make money is by raising the overall amount of revenue that they bring in. And that's why they'll sometimes accept extremely high prices. And so I got into this by writing about the story of Michael Frank, which you mentioned. And Michael Frank went to a hospital in New York City, NYU Langone Hospital, which is one of the marquee named hospitals in New York City, for a hip replacement. And he ended up getting charged about $70,000 for a hip replacement that at other hospitals in New York City would cost anywhere from, say, $20,000 to $30,000. And Michael Frank happens to be an actuary, and he works in the health insurance industry, and so he knows how it works. And he was flabbergasted to see, why are they accepting this extremely high price? Why is Aetna, my insurance company, paying $70,000? He thought it had to be fraud. And so he complained to everyone he could complain to, and the insurance company was happy to pay that amount. They just said, this is the rate that we have agreed to with the hospital. And what patients don't realize is that insurance companies also make money by creating these networks of providers, hospitals and doctors. And so, you know, an insurance company needs a hospital like NYU Langone in their network.
Yeah, it looks good.
And so they're going to pay them more and they're going to accept that. But then the patient ends up bearing the brunt of that cost.
Yeah. It's very, very complicated. There's a lot of themes and devices that are being used to fuel this industry that we have so little control over. And we think things operate a certain way, but in fact, they don't. My guest is Marshall Allen, and he's a reporter for ProPublica. I really recommend that you go up on that site, ProPublica. It's a nonprofit newsroom for investigative journalism. And of course, to hear this or any other interview again. And if you have a question about what we've discussed, write to us. We'd love to hear from you. And go to our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update for a brief rundown on the important topics that we've covered that week. Go straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Marshall, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.